Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Soleri Report. Today is a very special treat for me. It's somebody I've wanted to interview and meet for quite a long time. His name is Dr. Toby Rogers. He hails from California. Let me just read you his resume because it's very impressive and I want to get it right. Dr. Toby Rogers has a PhD in political economy from the University of Sydney in Australia. His doctoral thesis, The Political Economy of Autism, explores the regulatory history of five classes of toxicants that increase autism risk. Dr. Rogers shows that the public health problem of autism starts with the political economy problem of regulatory capture. He also has a Master's of Public Policy degree from the University of California, Berkeley, where he was a researcher for former U.S. Laboratory Secretary Robert Reich. Dr. Rogers is now a fellow at the Brownstone Institute, where he writes about corruption in the pharmaceutical industry and the revolution we need to stop the epidemics of chronic illness in children. Now, what I want, our title today is Pricing the Great Poison with Dr. Toby Rogers, and I want to tell you why I think Toby Rogers' contribution to what is happening is so very significant, is because for decades I tried to get a world of people to talk about the financial cost to a family, to a county, to a state, to a country of what was happening with injections and the great poisoning. And it was as though there was a trance and there was a force field. And along comes this guy named Dr. Toby Rogers, who writes his PhD at the University of Sydney, publishes it, it goes viral, and he shatters the trance. And I can't tell you, Toby, what a difference it made to me that you did that. It was incredible because, you know, I always love to talk about how does the money work on this? How does the money work on that? But I could never get the conversation going. And you just, I don't know what the trance was, but you broke it. And I'm deeply, deeply grateful.
Oh, wow. Well, that is so kind, Catherine. Thank you so much for that wonderful introduction. I'm a huge fan of you, a huge fan of all the work that you do. And I build on a lot of the work that you do as well. And look, I just put in the hard yards of trying to understand what was happening with autism. Right. And I'm delighted that it's found an audience. And you and I both believe in doing the work and doing it in the right way, doing it in the old school way. And Sometimes it breaks through, not always, but sometimes.
Well, you did it, and it's because you did such a thorough and excellent job of what you call the hard work. Now, before we dive in, I just want to ask you how you got to the University of Sydney, because until the pandemic, Sydney was one of my favorite cities in the whole world. It's absolutely smashing and beautiful and a wonderful place. How did you happen to go from University of California to Sydney?
Yeah, so there are only about 10 political economy departments left in the world. So 200 years ago, politics, political science, and economics were not separate fields. Instead, political science, economics, and moral philosophy were all one topic, and it was called political economy. And I think that's actually the right way to study these topics. The politics, the economics, and the moral philosophy all have to be woven together. There's only about 10 places in the world that are still doing it that way. And the University of Sydney has this legendary old school political economy department that weaves together political science, economics, and moral philosophy. And that's the approach that I think is the right way to think about the economy. And so I had my heart set on going there, and it took me 6 years worth of efforts to eventually get in and get funding and that sort of thing. And it was a dream come true. I love Sydney, and I love the Department of Political Economy at the University of Sydney.
Oh, that's wonderful. Wonderful. Okay, so I want to explain the great poisoning. For many, many years at the Soleri Report, we've referred to a phenomena called the great poisoning, which is a deterioration in the health of, we started with Americans as a result of increases in toxicity and a deterioration in general health. And much of it related to toxins being interjected into them or the environment in a whole variety of ways. So it's deterioration of the food system, it's, things being sprayed, it's pesticides, it's many different things, but included clearly injections. And I was an investment advisor for many years and had a lot of clients come to me who had one or more children harmed by vaccine injury. And that put me in a position of pricing out the exact cost to a family in both time and money and other costs of what these things were, what one vax injury could do to a family, and cost it out again and again and again. And yet, and that's why I felt it was desperate. I really was desperate to get the conversation going about pricing. And so then you came along and you just made my day. So let's dive in. Your dissertation was on the political economy of autism, but you've written subsequent articles about it. So tell us a little bit about how you came to do this and what the study did and what you found.
Yeah, so I had not initially intended to study autism. When I started my PhD work, I was actually working on a doctoral thesis on Adam Smith. And then 1 year into my program, my then girlfriend's son was diagnosed as being on the autism spectrum. And I had a passing familiarity with autism. My mom was a special education teacher growing up, but I'd never really studied the issue in depth. So one Saturday, I decided to set aside 8 hours to read everything I could to just wrap my head around what was happening with autism. And I quickly discovered that autism rates are skyrocketing, the costs are astronomical, and very little of what the CDC says about what's happening with autism actually checks out when compared with the underlying scientific literature. And this was startling to me. I had stumbled into, by accident, one of the most important political economy questions of the last century. We're in the middle of this autism epidemic. Government refuses to acknowledge it. Government refuses to do anything about it. And this is very strange. And this all needs to be explained and sorted out. So my 1 day of reading turned into two and then into 3 days. And then I'd done nothing but read about autism for 6 weeks. And I had to go into my supervisor's office and have a very difficult conversation and tell him what had happened. And we had very painful discussions back and forth, but eventually I changed my doctoral thesis topic to the political economy of autism. And I spent the next 4 years reading everything that's been published about the causes and costs of autism. And basically what I was trying to figure out is why the political system has refused to engage with an epidemic that is so large that it threatens to crash the US economy, the global economy, our entire political system. The suffering is just off the charts, and government acts like it's not happening at all. And so that's what I worked through. And the good news is my thesis passed rigorous external peer review. And I got my PhD I got my PhD in 2019. And this was sort of the last moment before mainstream science and medicine just sort of collapsed into fascism and demagoguery. And this was sort of the last moment when you could still do honest research on this topic before the madness of COVID and what have you.
But you got this published and it went viral, is my impression.
Well, that's what's extraordinary. So a good doctoral thesis in my department will be downloaded maybe 2,000 to 3,000 times. My doctoral thesis has been downloaded 75,000 times. It's found an audience around the world, and it's in the top 15 all time at the University of Sydney. So in the entire history of the university, my thesis has been downloaded. It's in the top 15 all time at the university. So that's pretty extraordinary. And that's just in the last 3 or 4 years. Right. You know, others have been around much longer. But the most gratifying part for me is I get messages from parents around the world saying, I was terrified about autism. I didn't understand it. I didn't know how to protect my kids. And I read your thesis, and now I know exactly what to do to protect my kids.
Right.
And quite literally, I get messages from parents saying, you saved my kid's life. And I never expected that to happen. But there's sort of, it's being passed around sort of underground through word of mouth, between parents, between moms, and it's found this audience, and it's really been extraordinary.
Right. And you do a very good job of describing sort of the, you know, you list the causes or potential causes and research out, you know, what the chances are that they're contributing. And that tells a parent, okay, these are the five aspects of the great poisoning I need to protect against.
Exactly. So
right.
I read the entire toxicological literature in connection with causes of autism. So there are various people who try to maintain that it's just better awareness or what's called diagnostic substitution, which is changes in diagnosis over time. But we have two very good studies out of the University of California at Davis that show that the increase in autism prevalence is real and it's massive over the last 50 years or so. And so basically in 1970, we had an autism rate of 1 in 10,000. And then by the early 80s, it was 1 in 5,000, 1 in 2,500 kids. And then in the late 1980s, something happens and the autism rate skyrockets, and such that it's now 1 in 33 kids today have autism. And so I wanted to understand why this is happening. We know that it's real. We know that there's something in the environment that's driving this. So I read everything. And we know that mercury from coal-fired power plants, diesel trucks, that increases your risk somewhat. If you live downwind from a coal-fired power plant, your risk will go up somewhat. We know that plastics and fire retardants are a problem. We know that pesticides and herbicides increase your risk. So if you live near a field that's sprayed with various pesticides while you're pregnant, that can increase autism risk somewhat. EMF, Martha Herbert at Harvard has done very good work on the risks of EMF cell phone towers. That increases your risk somewhat. But as you know, the real risks come from pharmaceuticals, Tylenol, SSRIs, and vaccines.
Right.
And vaccines are the main story. Unfortunately, all roads lead back to vaccines. So all these other toxicants that I've described, those are sort of the background conditions,
right,
that sort of set the stage. And then the pharmaceuticals, particularly vaccines, are what push children over the edge into regressive autism.
Right. And what we saw in the 80s was the introduction of the and growth of the heavy schedule.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So the 1986 Act gives National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act gives liability protection to the pharmaceutical industry. So now they can't be sued for harms from vaccines. And so then the vaccine schedule just becomes an ATM machine for right. the pharmaceutical industry. Every vaccine that they can add to the schedule generates $1 billion in revenue for them. And so their goal is to add as many vaccines as possible to the schedule. And so the schedule triples following the passage of the 1986 Act, and autism rates skyrocket right. as well. So yeah, we know what's happening there. It's just,
so before we talk about the cost to government and society, let's talk about the cost to one family.
Sure.
What are the costs of autism to one family, and how did you source the information you needed to make an estimate of that?
Yeah, so there are very good studies. There's sort of 7 to 9 cost of autism studies for the whole society. And then within that, they break down costs for individuals and families. And these models, they look at a number of different factors.
Right.
So increased costs for education. So bringing in a tutor or an aide in the classroom, increased costs for medical care. So autism, most people on the spectrum have a whole bunch of comorbid conditions, whether it's seizures, chronic pain, inability to sleep, all sorts of additional comorbid conditions. So medical costs go up. We also see caregiving costs. So mothers usually leave the workforce and return right. home to care for the child. So that imposes costs on the families. And then for more severe cases of autism, you have long-term costs of supportive housing. Perhaps they don't live with the family anymore, but they live in a residential setting, and the housing costs are significant. So there's a way to build these models, and there's sort of 7 to 9 big studies, and there's little studies that look at individual costs within that that are used to build the larger studies. So what we see is if the child has autism but does not have a co-occurring intellectual disability, this was back in about 2015, the costs were about $1.4 million, additional lifetime costs for someone with autism but no intellectual disability. If they
now
do
that
have
just reflects money, that doesn't reflect time.
Well said. Well said.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And it does reflect lost earnings, but you're correct. It doesn't reflect the value of time. And this was a pretty good study out of London School of Economics that looked at both the US and the UK. And it said that if the child also has an intellectual disability, we're looking at lifetime care costs of $2.4 million. Now, I've seen your model as well that shows a range of $1 million to $5 million. And I actually think your model is excellent. I think because you value time, I think your model is better than a lot of the existing models.
So part of it is time, but part of it is what a parent believes they need to put up in terms of money and trust for a lifetime of care after they're gone.
Yeah.
And the care is not only care, but the care is supervision that makes sure that the care is acceptable because they're not there. And that's where the big numbers come in, particularly if the autism is heavy autism.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the problem right now that I'm trying to get lawmakers to pay attention to, and it's very difficult in this COVID age where critical thinking has been criminalized in this country, and there's just sort of this hypnosis amongst policymakers around questions of vaccines and health and what have you. But let me paint the picture here, which is autism rates are skyrocketing. And this 1986 generation, children born after the 1986 Act, it's this large population of kids with autism. And right now, the costs of caring for these kids are borne mostly by parents, some by government, some by insurance carriers, but mostly by parents. Well, those parents are eventually going to die,
right,
somewhere around 2040. And when that happens, you're going to have millions of now adults with autism. They're not going to have parents to care for them anymore. So costs that are currently borne by families are going to shift onto government in a massive way. I mean, right, in the trillions of dollars. And government has no plan whatsoever for dealing with this tsunami of costs. They're going to move onto the public books that are currently shouldered by parents. This is a
I would say this, Toby, they have no disclosed plan.
Okay. Well, and candidly, what we see, particularly from Democratic lawmakers in California, where I am right now, it's rather sinister, right?
Right.
So they pass these vaccine mandate bills. So in California, you can't even get a medical exemption to a vaccine for your kid to go to school. Forget philosophical, religious exemptions. Those were gone in 2015. You can't even get a medical exemption. So if your brother died from a vaccine, the sibling cannot get a medical exemption to opt out of the vaccine schedule. So when California does this, what happens is they forced 55,000 families out of California. They became medical refugees. They moved to Texas and Florida and free red states because right. they couldn't get an education anymore. So lawmakers refuse to acknowledge what's happening with autism, but subconsciously, what are they doing? Well, they're kicking them out of school already.
Right.
Right. To reduce costs. And I shudder to even think what other subconscious things they could do down the road to reduce costs. That's right. that's the danger here.
I think they're already doing it. I mean, we're going to talk about the political economy of a poison population, but I think, you know, I've spent a lot of time since 1998 trying to warn people about money disappearing from the federal government. So there's 21 trillion of unverified, undocumentable adjustments between 1998 and 2015, and then they went dark. So we don't know what the undocumentable adjustments are. But if you, when Dr. Mark Skidmore did the first survey, and we got the number up to 21 trillion, I only had it to 12 trillion. He and his students found another $9 trillion. But, you know, at that point, the outstanding debt was $21 trillion, and there were $21 trillion of unverified adjustments. And so there was only, the reason I kept warning people was there was only one way to deal with that problem. If you didn't deal with it through the financial budget, you had to lower life expectancy. And it was, it's math. If you don't up the savings rate or move out the retirement rate, you have to lower life expectancy. And when they started the process of money disappearing from the federal government, literally they gave up. They had the budget deal in October 1995. A group of people threw up their hands and said, "That's it, we give up." The next month, they approved OxyContin and the pill mills and HUD predatory lending, and started the beatdown on poor neighborhoods, both in the city and rural areas, that started to immediately lower life expectancy.
Wow.
It was like boom, boom.
Wow. And now 100,000 people a year dying from opioids, 50,000 from suicide, and hundreds of thousands from COVID vaccine injury.
I think life expectancy in the U.S. has dropped 3 years in the last 3 years, right?
Yeah. The Tony Fauci effect. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, as horrible as that sounds, you know, life expectancy for the people who govern the financial system, life expectancy is one of the most important indicators of, you know, tracking management of a variety of different things, including happiness. You know, people are happy and life is better because life expectancy is going up. People are unhappy, life expectancy is going down, but it balances it helps to balance the books. But there's no way you can balance the books for the autism epidemic without lowering life expectancy.
Wow. Yeah, that's what I appreciate especially about your approach. It's in political science, we call it realpolitik. You see things as they are rather than how we wish they would be, right?
Right.
It's just numbers, right? People are making calculations. They're deciding accordingly. Unfortunately, it's horrific.
Yeah, it is horrific. Although I think the people who lead the process would say, well, you know, we tried to get financial responsibility for decades and the population refused to go along with it. And so what is it you expect us to do? I mean, there, you know, there's a lot of frustration in the political system about trying to get financial accountability. Mm. And unfortunately, it has resulted in a real cycle of disrespect. And you and I are sitting in the middle looking at the economics of it. So tell us a little bit about, I was very intrigued by the Paul Thomas study. Can we talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So Paul Thomas, Dr. Paul Thomas in Portland, Oregon, is the best doctor in the world at preventing autism. So there's sort of five or six very good studies that compare unvaccinated to vaccinated populations. And all these are independent studies. Government will never fund these studies, but independent researchers have gone out and done the work. So Dr. Paul Thomas took a look at his patient population. And in Portland, Oregon, he had the most successful pediatric practice in the whole state. And so he looked through his medical records. He brought in some additional scientific researchers to support him in this effort. And what he found is the following. So he basically divided his patient population into three groups. So if the child had zero vaccines, the rate of autism was 1 in 715. So that's those are the background sort of underlying what you might call the natural rate, just from the other toxicants that a child's exposed to. If they follow his alternative schedule, he had this really pared down schedule. It just had a few vaccines, really spaced out, really kept an eye on making sure aluminum levels were not too high. Well, if the family followed the alternative schedule, the rate of autism was 1 in 440. And if a child came into his practice who had followed the CDC's vaccine schedule prior to coming into his practice, the autism rate was 1 in 36. So this was a very good study. It had a large sample size, over 3,000 patients, access to medical files, which you don't always have, really good researchers working on it. So, but if you think about it, his alternative schedule reduces risk of autism by 1,200%. But even an alternative schedule increases autism risk by 160% versus no vaccines at all. And so this came out in 2016. There's been a more recent study that updated it and confirmed these findings and also looked at things like ADHD and ear infections and that sort of thing. And those were all higher in the vaccinated population as well. And since then, Dr. Paul Thomas has been hunted like a dog.
I know.
By the scientific and medical establishment. So the Oregon Medical Board stripped his license, and then there was that was temporary, and then it was reinstated, and then he was forced into retirement. Now he's practicing under the sovereignty of an indigenous tribe that has sovereignty outside of the United States system or inside the United States mm-hmm. system. But it's completely outrageous. This guy is the best doctor in the world.
So here's what's interesting, because hunted. I had subscribers who tried very hard to persuade their relatives not to take the COVID injection.
Okay.
And the first thing that really broke through and persuaded other people, you know, that they used, we did an interview with, James Lyon Wheeler about the Paul Thomas study. And one of the things that Thomas was able to calculate was how much more money he as a doctor made from the heavy schedule. In other words, a child who was not vaccinated, he hardly made any money on. The kids who were heavily vaccinated, he made significantly more money from those kids.
Yeah. Yeah. Follow the money is always the smart principle in figuring out what's going on. And well, yes, pediatricians are making money from the schedule and from harming kids.
So many people said, oh my God, now I see how the doctors are making money, because they couldn't conceive of why the doctors wouldn't warn people. They just couldn't believe it was this bad. Anyway, so that was an astonishing, and he's a very courageous man, wonderful doctor.
Extraordinary human being. He should be considered for the Nobel Prize in Medicine. He's an extraordinary human being.
So let's talk about a family. So now we're talking, you know, I've said 1 to 5 million, you say 1 to 2.8, and that's not including all the time. But let's talk about who pays for that. The family pays for that, but doesn't government... You know, even if I don't have an autistic kids, I have to pay for all the services that are necessary in the school system or in the community. And that's going to bite into the budget and the services the government can provide, right?
Right. So right now there's several different groups that pay for the cost of autism. So mostly families, parents, government. Everything from Medicaid to supportive housing services to additional wraparound supportive services. Insurance pays some, but not a lot.
Right.
But those costs are going to shift over time. Those are going to move more towards government over time. So When I started work on this back in 2015, the costs of autism to the United States alone were $268 billion a year back in 2015.
Right.
And the study that came out then projected that autism costs would hit $1 trillion a year per year by 2025. So just 2 years from now. And just to put that in perspective.
So the military budget right now is about $800, $850 billion.
Yeah.
Interest on the debt has gone higher. But basically, you're talking about competing with interest on all the debt or the entire military budget.
Right, right. But with the defense bill, at least there's a conversation about it.
Right.
With autism costs, there's no conversation about it. It just kind of happens.
Right.
But the costs are becoming unsustainable. And the problem is places like California that don't want to have a conversation about what's happening do all these weird things to cut costs, like kicking kids out of school. The tragedy here, as you know, but I want to underscore, is all of this is preventable. We keep toxic chemicals out of kids' bodies, particularly toxic chemicals in these vaccines. The cost will come down by $1 trillion a year. We know how to do this right now, but there's no political will yet to stop poisoning kids. It's such a, that's what our economy is based on now, poisoning kids.
Right. So, I'm not sure if you're aware of this. During COVID, many people could not access an attorney or sort of the legal advice they needed to know about what their rights were and how to exercise them. So we ended up making a series of forms that would teach you sort of how to represent yourself and be your own attorney. And they were patterned after forms used by financial planners for various events and other things, planning, you know, their planning tools. And the first one was called the Family Financial Disclosure Form. And I don't know if you, have you looked at it?
Yeah, it's extraordinary. Yeah. You did brilliant work on that.
So, well, actually it was, I'll tell you later, there was, because we had some very wonderful help. But essentially what we tried to do was say, this came up with one spouse arguing with another, basically saying, okay, you know, I'm going to require you to do due diligence and force you to do real due diligence. And after you do the due diligence, if you still want to take this risk, you have to take the steps with disability insurance, health insurance, life insurance, and other arrangements so that if your game of Russian roulette costs money and time, it will not bankrupt the family. In other words, you have to build the moats around the castle so that you will not bankrupt the family. With, you know, you don't have the right to bankrupt the family without our permission. Mm-hmm. And it was designed to do that. And it was, you know, my feedback is spouses were able to talk their spouses out of getting the shot, or they were able to talk their spouses into making the arrangement so that if there was an adverse event, they were protected. And,
wow.
And it was astonishing because there were so many, you know, again, there's this trance about we can't talk about money or money's not important or, I don't know. There's an inability to be practical about these things that is really scary. It's almost, again, it's for me, it's like a trance. But one of the ways the trance came off was I was having a huge, when I'm as an investment advisor, my attitude, it's your money. You should do whatever you want with your money. I'm happy to give you my opinion, but it's your money. I don't get aggressive about telling you can't do something, right? And but I had one subscriber who said to me, you know, my daughter is going to vaccinate my grandchildren. It's not my business. I said, really? I said, you know, I said 1 to 5 million. Does your daughter have 1 to 5 million to pay if, you know, the child is vaccine injured? And he said, no. I said, do you? He said, oh, yeah. I said, really? Did you work all your life building a company and selling it, and making $5 million so you could waste it on one vaccine injury? And he stopped and he said, you're right. I'm the family bank. It is my business. Anyway, so that became an article called Injection Fraud, which we published at the beginning of the pandemic. But I wanted you to know we did this huge wrap up called the Injection Fraud with a picture of a big horse shot injection on the front. And we printed all of them, a couple thousand copies in Europe, sent it out in the mail, and it disappeared for 3 months. A couple thousand copies mail just totally disappeared. And then so we had to reprint it again, 21,000 euros. I had to reprint the whole thing and mail it. And about 3 days after it arrived in, you know, most of the 1,000 desks, the other one happened to show up. So everybody got two.
Wow.
Right. Wow. Exactly. Wow.
So the anyway. German mail system censored an informed consent document during the middle
so
of a
here's
pandemic.
What happened. We mailed it in the Netherlands and it disappeared for 3 months into a warehouse in Hamburg that no one could figure out where it was.
Extraordinary.
It was. It was very special. Very expensive. Anyway, but that is the, you know, that is the value of good intelligence is all I can say. Anyway, so the thing that inspired, so this is the background on your dissertation and your work on the cause of autism. But then something happened the other day that was so marvelous and so clear. I have to give you background. I was reading somebody's commentary comparing the current economy with the economy of 50 years ago. And I was taking the position that that is a ridiculous comparison, because an economy where productivity is growing and you're exporting and making real things versus you're simply caring for people who are being poisoned is, you know, there's no comparison. You can't look at that with mathematics. You can't look at that statistically and think you're comparing, you know, it's apples and oranges. So just then you come out with a new Substack that is, I have to compliment you, one of the most brilliant, you know, you get somebody writing a piece which is just like breakthrough thinking. It just simplifies, it clarifies, it's so coherent, it's a major contribution, and everyone goes, ah, you know, and it changes the framework. So it's like a trim tab, it changes the framework. So tell us about this breakthrough piece, what happened, how you came to write it, and what it says.
Yeah, so as I said, I initially started my PhD work thinking about Adam Smith, and he wrote Wealth of Nations, and I think it's a very interesting work that's influenced economics for hundreds of years. And then my mentor, Robert Reich at UC Berkeley, he wrote The Work of Nations, which is sort of a progressive interpretation on the Wealth of Nations and reframing. And that's how he got to be labor secretary. And so honestly, I was in jury duty and I was stuck there. And you know how it is in jury duty. And you think, if I ever get out of here, what am I going to do with my life if I survive this? So I started thinking about what a new Wealth of Nations would look like.
Right.
And how we might think through the well-being of a nation. But as I look at the economic debate in the New York Times, online, in the Atlantic, what have you, what strikes me about the debate is how completely irrelevant it is right now. So there are all these longstanding debates in economics. As you know, conservatives like to think about supply side issues and issues of production and entrepreneurship, prices, markets, taxation, that sort of thing. Progressives like to think about unions and minimum wage and discrimination in the labor market, that sort of thing. None of that matters right now, because we're in the midst of this mass poisoning of society.
Right.
That started in 1986 and accelerated in 2021, end of 2020,
right,
with these COVID shots. And this mass poisoning of society, it's never happened on this scale before.
Right.
There have been targeted groups, you know, Nazi right. Germany, what have you. There have been wars, there's been slavery, but we've never had the mass poisoning of the entire population
right.
by government and industry.
It's a massive slow kill. It's a massive, yeah. massive slow kill.
Right. And it
right.
it changes everything about how we should think about the economy. And so all these existing debates, they can't really explain what's going on right now, because they're unable to speak about sort of the real gravity of the situation, the dark matter in this model, which is the poisoning of society. And so I wrote this Substack article on my Substack, tobyrogers.substack.com. And the article was called "How Then Shall We Think About the Economy?" And it was an attempt to build an economic model that actually thinks about the way that mass poisoning of the whole population is changing our economy in ways that we've never had to grapple with before. And no economic model is going to work going forward unless we deal with this mass poisoning event.
So I just want to take a pause for a second. There's a very famous book, and it was, I can't remember if it was written by a Swiss or German. How shall we go forward, or how now shall we go forward? Do you know the one I'm talking about?
No.
Oh, I was wondering if it was a play on that title. So
I'll
find that.
But subconsciously these things work sometimes.
I'll find that and send it to you, because that is one you would find very interesting. But okay, so tell us a little bit about more what you said in this article.
Okay, so right now the U.S. economy is organized around doing three or four things. We poison people with pharma, pesticides, these Frankenfoods, Nabisco, what have you. We engage in war. We're really, defense contractors do really well. We generate energy through, drilling, oil, coal, natural gas, alternative sources. And the U.S. also has an entire industry around forgetting.
Right.
Our media is about sort of a mass hypnosis to make us forget how bad things are. And big finance provides the financing for this, and big tech provides the surveillance to make this happen. But here's what I wrote about. So this actuality of how our economy is organized, it creates the appearance of a lot of economic activity.
Right.
Right. So let's walk through some of these numbers, because they're just shocking. So the vaccine schedule generates about $50 billion a year. And then treating vaccine injuries, so seizures, autism, cancer, diabetes, learning disabilities, ADHD, well, that's a $500 billion a year industry. So we spend 10 times more on treating vaccine injury versus the original cost. And that was all pre-COVID. Those costs now, with blood clots and strokes and heart disease, myocarditis, pericarditis, those costs easily could be approaching $1 trillion a year.
So I would like to point out, though, that what you're describing is the revenues and expenses in the system. What you're not describing is the extraordinary real estate play that comes from building all the facilities that explosion requires, which is quite remarkable. I've tried to cost that out, and it's quite remarkable, particularly in the 90s and 2000s. And what you're also not costing out is how that revenue translates through the stock market into capital gains on the market, and how that translates into political contributions back to the politicians. So when you multiply it out through the financial system and then back into the pockets of politicians, you're talking about trillions and trillions of dollars.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. That is our economy. That's what we do. And right. Yeah. And we have another sort of $250 billion a year in neurological industry, but I love those additions there. And so.
You go.
So we have this appearance of tons of economic activity, right? We have this appearance that our, GDP is great, but it appears great because we spend 10 times to 100 times trying to fix the harms that are caused by pharma. So pharma and the chemical industry are sort of upriver from society. They poison all of us. They make some money from that, and then they make all this money downstream from treatments and, as you point out, real estate, capital gains, and the rest. And so we pay 10 to 100 times more than, it's like digging a hole and then filling it in again, and then digging the hole and then filling it in again, over and over and over again. It's sort of Sisyphean, in our approach to the economy. And the result is people are sick. They're dying early. They're miserable. They're not, their families are falling apart. People aren't doing well. There's misery in this country. And one of the things I like to point out to politicians and anybody who will listen candidly is going forward, this is going to create a whole series of crises. We're already in a crisis, but there's no way to do economic stimulus going forward.
So let me posit a framework,
okay,
a conceptual framework for what is going on, and look at it at the prism through economic warfare.
Okay.
So for many, many decades, we have bubbled the economy with paper. So it's called the debt growth model. And we've printed more and more paper and more and more paper. So you've probably heard me talk about, you know, at HUD, I would find homes, which I believed, you know, 10 mortgages on one house, kind of paper, you know, highly fraudulent. You know, there's a real collateral fraud problem. Okay. And so we've have many more times the paper that has a call on real assets than there are real assets and income to support the paper. But we've kept the paper floating. It's like, you know, it's like keeping the balloons up in the air. Okay, so now the debt growth model is over. You know, the control system is in place. And now the real question is, okay, if we can't satisfy growth with more debt, who's going to get the real assets? So you have the political machinery turning and getting ready to shift into, it's a reset. And the critical issue is, okay, game of musical chairs. If the real assets are hypothecated more than one time into the paper, who's going to get, when the music stops, who's going to get the real chair? So there's a serious competition for asserting control of the land, the water, the livestock, all the real resources. And if you look at the pandemic, what you see is the people who want to assert that control shutting down the businesses and income and poisoning the people who they want to take it from. And so you have an insider-outsider game. The outsiders are being poisoned. It doesn't look to me like the insiders are being poisoned.
So that's a brilliant model. And that's the horror that we live with. They've securitized our bodies, right?
Right.
They've turned our bodies into assets, just like the toxic mortgages in the early 2000s. They've securitized our bodies. And they've turned our bodies and our chronic illness into revenue streams.
Right.
And there's only two ways that this can go, right? If we continue down this path, it's a dystopia. It's a nightmare. It's a pharma dystopia. It's a pharma dark ages. And once a dark ages starts, who knows how long that can last? Maybe 1,000 years. I don't know.
So what they want is they want complete financial transaction control. And it helps them to get that if a combination of poisoning and forgetting, and I love your description of that, if a combination of poisoning and forgetting can stop us from seeing the game and stopping them. That's, you know, so that's the question. Can the rest of us see what's happening and shift the consciousness around this and shift into a different kind of reset? And that's what you're about. That's what everybody working on this is about. And that's why I think your both your thesis and your Substack has been so helpful to break through both sometimes you call it amnesia, but you break through all this pretzel talk of the economy's up 5% here. I call it the ups and downs. You know, you break through all of that. It's just fabulous. And that's when we can start to grapple with the hard truth because, you know, a lot of in politics, there's an official story and then there's reality. And a lot of times the official story is not to persuade somebody of a false narrative. It's to give them a false narrative so they can pretend that they don't have to do anything and they can stay on the couch. They're looking to stay on the couch. They just want, you know, to feel good about themselves. So the question for us is, can we, you know, by looking at things this way, can they say, you know something? It's better to come off the couch. Right. You know, particularly, and I go back to the moms, if parents can use what you are providing to protect their children, it can make an enormous difference. I mean, the only reason there's one in 35 kids becoming autistic is parents still listen to the official story. If they can stop listening to the official story, we need another Rich Man from Richmond song about poisoning.
Yeah. Well, the horror of COVID vaccines has woken a lot of parents up. So, I mean, something like 90% of parents opt out of COVID vaccines for their kids. And good. That's remarkable. Those are higher numbers than we've ever seen before of people opting out. And some of that's carrying over to the rest of the schedule, but it's not moving fast enough for my preference. But yeah, you're exactly right. So the future that we get from the Biden administration, the ruling class, the Bill Gates, the World Health Organization, what have you, it's this two-tiered system of a small ruling class. All the rest of us are livestock. I love your use of that term, that just generates revenue for the ruling class. And then there's various ways to hypnotize us with AI and video games and entertainment and what have you, so that we don't protest. And that's just a nightmare. No, we do not want to live in that world. And then the alternative is the world that you're building, that I'm working to build, that Robert Kennedy is working to build, that Ron DeSantis has spoken to eloquently. And it's the only path forward if the whole of humanity is actually going to do well and thrive. We know what we have to do. We have to keep toxic chemicals out of kids' bodies and out of everybody's body. And that starts with keeping pharmaceutical products that are harmful out of people's bodies. And when you do that, though, I mean, a lot of what I do is just sort of naming the obvious thing that's right in front of us in the room. But literally, when you do that, when you keep toxic chemicals out of people's bodies, you generate trillions of dollars a year in economic stimulus that makes everybody better. The fact that every politician hasn't already embraced this is maddening.
Well, but here's the thing. You generate enormous economic activity that doesn't translate into direct capital gains. The pharmaceuticals are delivering direct capital gains that, you know, direct, you know, but, and they also have some covert operations that help this go as well. But so, you know, all we need is, you know, it's like priming the pump, is a couple of politicians, which is happening now, talking sense. And the more that happens, the more it can go. You know, somebody said to me, I believe that American elections are rigged. And I said, American elections might be rigged, but the conversation is not. And the conversation is very, very important, which is why I think this campaign is going to be, it's phenomenally interesting now. It's going to keep getting more interesting because there are serious discussions happening. And I think they're changing people. Okay, so let me ask you, what are you going to be doing? You just joined the Brownstone Institute. What are you going to be doing?
I'm going to be writing about corruption in the pharmaceutical industry, how we stop this madness. But I also like to zoom out and look at these sort of larger economic questions of economic modeling to actually have a real economic model of what we're doing and paint the picture for how we might go forward. And I'm trying to sort out the big political theory questions as well. So is the current crisis the result of the collapse of liberalism? Did liberalism fail? Or did we just fail to properly implement sort of classical liberalism? And sort of the big political questions that have been raised by the current crisis. And mostly I want to paint a picture for how we exit this death cult system that we're in right now, and how we start winning elections and that sort of thing so that we don't have to live in this dystopia going forward. And to respond to your last comment, this is a classic collective action problem. right? So the wealth is concentrated in the hands of a few pharmaceutical companies, a few big philanthropies, and that sort of thing, philanthropaths. And they make political contributions. Politicians know exactly who's funding them in the next election cycle. And the diffuse gains that happen from not poisoning people, those are more difficult to organize collectively. Right. And so the challenge that Robert Kennedy's campaign is going to face, the challenge that Ron DeSantis' campaign is going to face, is how do you build the mass of small donors and a real genuine revolutionary movement to topple this dystopian model that we've gotten from Bill Gates.
So let me make your job a little bit more complicated.
Okay.
In a way that ultimately will make it simple. And that is, you're not just dealing with the money. The big money here is not the pharma money.
Mm.
The big money here is the real estate money.
Oh, far out.
The big money here is consolidation of the financial transaction control and control of the federal credit. Because the healthcare line, I just did a great interview with James Rogowski, which will help you understand my thinking on this. Because we should have a conversation about, you know, our next conversation should be, okay, how do you get to a real reset given the play? But think of this as a tripod, okay? You've got the media forgetting operation in the middle. You've got the central bankers here, and you've got the healthcare. And the central bankers are hiding behind the healthcare skirts, okay? Because, you know, it's real easy for the crowd to turn against the bankers and the central bankers. But if suddenly I want to drop a team of scientists in a neighborhood and say, Toby Rogers' house has an invisible pathogen that could kill all of us in the basement. We need to quarantine. We need to confiscate. We need to do eminent domain. There are 1,000 different things you can do, but we need to move in here and take control. You know, we can burn it down, but we can also use the WHO pathogen team to do surveillance and intercede anywhere in the world under, you know, if they get their treaty. It's a real estate play. It's a real estate play. And the reason the system is going to work is not because of the WHO or their powers. It's going to work because the bankers behind the scenes are willing to institute trade and credit controls to make sure everybody complies down the line.
So those are the assets in the game of musical chairs that they want to make sure that they get. Those are real assets.
So the bubble is coming to an end. The debt growth model is over. And now the question is, who's going to control the real assets?
Yeah.
You know, and part of this is a coup because in a democratic process, you have to share control. They don't want to share control. So the guys who control monetary policy want to control fiscal policy. But they want to make sure they control who gets the real assets, and they want to wipe out property rights for most people. I mean, if they've got you in a slow kill, they're planning on taking your real estate. That's how it works.
Wow.
Right. So we're talking about, you know, asserting control of the whole federal credit and all the land and real estate. This is the whole ball of wax. So we're not just dealing with pharmaceutical profits here.
Yeah.
This is a much, much bigger game. The bankers are hiding behind the healthcare skirts.
Yeah. Oh, that's so brilliant. One of the things I did with my research is to show that capture is not just capture of politicians and regulatory agencies. It's capture of all knowledge producing industries in this country. And so my view extends capture to the whole of society. And what you've done that's so brilliant, those are pieces I don't have yet. The real estate.
Oh, you'll have them. I'll do everything I can to get them to you as fast
Fantastic.
As possible.
It's such a better model, but it explains so much more, right? It explains all the moves towards central bank digital currency. It explains the moves around social credit scores, around 15-minute cities, around all of the ESG stuff and that's being imposed upon us, climate scores and the rest of that. You can't get there just by blaming pharma, right? And you can't get there just by blaming the FDA and CDC for capture. That's just a piece of it. What you've done is build this whole of society, whole of economy model. I love it. It's beautiful. I mean, it's heartbreaking, right?
It's heartbreaking, but it's if we can see the world whole enough to figure out our actions, you know, they are few, we are many. So there's tremendous gains to be had by seeing the whole picture. And I, you know, one of the things that I believe is many people who are going along, who think it's their best strategy to go along, once they see where it's really going, they're like, you know something? I'm not going along with this. They see the advantage of getting off the couch. Anyway, so there are many more conversations we have to have, from how we reform pharma to, you know, how do we create a conceptual framework that people can understand? Because one of your geniuses is helping people break through that trance and seeing things in a very clear, coherent way. It really is a genius. And, you know, and I think you've done wonderful things, but I think your career here has only just begun.
Well, best of times, worst of times, right? I mean, intellectually, it's fascinating. I never expected that we would be dealing with a problem this complicated. And yet, I mean, it's such an honor to fight alongside you in this war in the trenches trying to save humanity. But wow, it's just shocking that we've ended up here. And wow, your work is so brilliant. And I can't wait to take pieces from your model, put it in mine, take pieces from my model, put it in yours. I think.
So can I send you a collection of our wrap-ups, just so that when I communicate with you, you have them there. They're much easier to read in hard copy. So if I just need a mailing address, so if you'll send me a mailing address, I'll send you a collection of our hard copies, and that will make it easier. Well, you know, you're doing great work. Everybody should go to your Substack. Can they subscribe or sign up? How do they follow your work?
Yeah, so I do most of my writing, thinking, publishing through Substack. It's been a great venue for me because it's free from censorship. So it's just tobyrogers.substack.com. There's free options, but people who think that I'm providing value can also do paid subscriptions. And
great.
And it's been great. I reach a ton of people every week, and the conversations that we have, the community that we've built in the comments is really lovely. And we're really trying to do a lot of what you're doing, which is to reframe the debate, understand it differently, and figure out a way to move forward. And to sort of name the elephant in the living room, right? It's just maddening to open the New York Times every day and have them not even able to acknowledge what's happening. And so we just try to.
Yeah, you know, I say it's like pouring saltwater taffy into a Ferrari engine. Ooh, goo. So, and has Robert Reich, so you used to work with Robert Reich, is he still actively following, you know, what's happening in the economy, and can you get him engaged in all of this? Because he's a wonderful man.
He's a good man. His narrative has been just standard Democratic Party,
right,
you know, rhetoric during this crisis. And we're seeing that a lot on the left, right? The left has not been able to engage with this crisis. I mean, the most heartbreaking one is Naomi Klein, right? Who's the best thinker on disaster capitalism. And when truckers rose up in Canada, she sided with Trudeau and the fascists against the working class. And that's just completely heartbreaking. And I write a lot about that, the sort of the collapse, the intellectual collapse of the left during this crisis. I don't know what it's going to take to wake them up, but the path that we're on is clearly unsustainable. And I feel like
we had a fabulous interview with Naomi Wolf a couple months ago, who has come, you know, she and Bobby Kennedy did this fabulous interview where she said, well, we're still progressives. Where did everybody else go?
Right.
Yeah.
COVID just turned off their brains. Vaccines just turn off their brains. But all heretofore existing political categories have been scrambled and shaken up by what's happened. I don't think there really is a left and right anymore going forward. It's either pro-fascism or pro-freedom going forward. And that's the hand that we've been dealt.
I always tell people, you have to choose. Do you want to resonate with the divine intelligence or God? Do you want to resonate with a machine? That's the choice.
Yeah.
So we know where we stand.
That's very effective framing. I'm going to start using that.
Okay. Okay. Well, Dr. Toby Rogers, it's a pleasure to know you. It's a pleasure now that we're in cahoots. And I look forward to doing more. If there's anything I can do, or we, the Solari team, can do to help you in your work, we're delighted to do so. So just think of us as in your corner. Okay.
Yes. Well, thank you so much. It's such a treat to be on your show and to get to, you know, brainstorm together with you about these things. And absolutely, let's collaborate going forward and figure out how to win the fight of our lifetime. And I'm so grateful for all your work. And I look forward to building more upon it. It's just extraordinary what you've done. You're doing life-saving work, and I look forward to working together. This is an amazing opportunity, heartbreaking times, but it's such a joy to be able to work together on this.
Well, we have a curriculum called Building Wealth, and I have to tell you, you're a wealth builder. So proud to know you. Okay, Toby, have a great day.
Thank you. You too.